Hey, fellow Okies and all true crime enthusiasts. I'm Cece, the host, writer, and producer of this, the Sooner State True Crime Podcast. Welcome, y'all, to the 8th episode of the show. In this episode, I'll briefly cover the cases of 4 missing people from Oklahoma or with direct ties to the state. Afterwards, I'll be joined for a special interview with the host of the True Crime Excess podcast, John. He will explain why he believes our missing people may be connected, and we'll discuss his podcast, True Crime Excess. Today, I'll cover the disappearances of Boaz Zeno, Inocente Yanez, Anthony Lennon, and Shannon Hokinson, 2 of which disappeared from Oklahoma, and the other with direct links to the case, and all are being investigated by Oklahoma police departments. So if you have any information regarding these cases, please check the show notes for the contact info. I'd also like to thank the Dating Confessions with Alicia and Jack podcast, Motherhood Unstressed CBD, and the Ghost Town podcast for sponsoring this episode. Links to each are listed in the show notes, along with all the links to my website, social media, and email, where I'm always interested in receiving your comments and case suggestions. Donate to the Chip Jar by visiting paypal.me/crimestate. The next episode of our podcast will be released on April 19th instead of the 15th for the 25th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. Please be sure y'all subscribe to us and support the show by leaving us a 5-star review in Apple Podcast. Thanks y'all so much. The response to the show has really blown me away. Now let's get started with our 4 missing persons we'll discuss this show. First, the early January of 1999, disappearance of Boaz Zeno and Inocente Yanez. Then, we'll talk about the March 2012, vanishing of Anthony Lennon, and then Shannon Hokinson. Following a brief recap of each case, I'll have host of the podcast, True Crime Excess, John, join me for an interview about his podcast. In addition, I'll talk to him about why he believes these 4 missing people may be connected. This episode is going to blow your mind, so come away with me to the years 1999 and 2012, and in the state of Oklahoma somehow, when Bo Zeno, Sean Yanez, Anthony Lennon, and Shannon Hokinson all vanished, never to be heard from alive again. Boaz Bo Zeno was born on December 31st, 1976, and grew up in New York City. Bo, which he was known as, was a 22-year-old white male that was 5 feet 10 inches tall, weighing 170 pounds, with dark brown hair and brown eyes, when he disappeared from Oakland, California, on January 3rd, 1999. Zeno had an abdominal scar, extending from his navel to pubic bone. He also had 2 moles above his upper lip, and 2 more moles on his right cheek. Zeno needed glasses to see long distances. Bo had been diagnosed with a mental illness prior to his vanishing. His illness required Bo to take the medication in order to try and control it. Zeno was prescribed the antipsychotic drugs Risperdal and Zyprexa. Prior to his disappearance, Zeno was a student at the State University of New York at Albany. Bo was originally a deanless student, but he dropped out of college in order to join the circus. He later re-enrolled, but did not finish. Zeno received incompletes in all of his classes. Bo later traveled to Israel and spent a few months at a yeshiva, which is a Jewish religious school. However, Bo dropped out and went to live with his grandmother in Tel Aviv shortly after. While in Israel, Zeno's behavior changed drastically. His behavior became so alarming to his mother that she flew to Tel Aviv and immediately made Bo seek psychiatric attention. At that time, Zeno was prescribed the antipsychotic drug Risperdal. He then was placed in a religious home for the mentally ill. His condition did eventually improve, so he left the group home. Within a few months after his mother went back home, Zeno quit taking his medication. Shortly after, Beau and his father went back to the U.S. together. A month after arriving in the United States, Beau was hospitalized again for mental illness. Once Zeno was finally released from the hospital, he immediately went and joined the U.S. Army. He did not, however, tell the Army about his mental illness issues, the hospital stays, or the several medications prescribed to treat his mental illness. That allowed Zeno to enlist in the U.S. Army on November 30, 1998. That same day, Beau spoke to his family back in New York City over the phone. In this conversation, Zeno sounded upbeat, and he explained his plans to visit family in Oakland, California. Several weeks later, on the day Zeno was leaving Fort Sill, Oklahoma, to travel to Oakland, California, he spoke with his father over the phone. After he had completed just 2 weeks of basic training at Fort Sill, Zeno received a two-week break for Christmas and New Year's. Beau Zeno loaded a bus in Lawton, Oklahoma, where Fort Sill is located, and he traveled to El Paso, New Mexico. There, Zeno changed buses, and he traveled on the same bus all the way to Oakland, California. Beau arrived in California on January 3, 1999. Reports state that Zeno, quote, saw off two other enlisted men from the bus in Oakland. Both men reportedly invited Zeno to join them and their families. He declined, explaining he was on his way to San Francisco to visit his own relatives. It's reported that Beau Zeno did rejoin the bus he rode in on, with the intention to travel on to San Francisco. It is unknown if Zeno ever arrived in San Fran, however. It was several weeks later, before Zeno was due back in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, for his Army training. Therefore, it was several weeks before he was reported missing to his family or any authorities. Police in both Oklahoma and California started working the missing persons case of Boaz Zeno. But due to the amount of time between his last sighting and the lack of any evidence or any information he had actually met with foul play, all caused the case to have very little clues. This motivated Beau's mother, Pamela Zio, to hire a private investigator in 2001 to search for her son. This detective believed that Beau was possibly homeless. Prior to his disappearance, Zeno had expressed admiration for the homeless and their resourcefulness. The PI's hunch was bolstered by several witnesses on the streets that reported seeing a man resembling Zeno, living on the streets in homeless shelters in the Oakland and Berkeley, California areas. Unfortunately, the private investigator his mother hired could never locate Beau Zeno. His mother, Pamela Zeno, said in an article, quote, "I searched my son for 4 years before I considered he might not want to be found. I even hired a private detective for $65 an hour plus expenses. I would have paid any amount to find Beau." Both the Lawton Police Department in Oklahoma and the California Department of Justice Sacramento office are working the January 3, 1999 disappearance of Boaz Beau Zeno. He was last seen alive in Oakland, California. So please, if you have any information, no matter big or small, that you can have to help, please contact the Lawton, Oklahoma Police Department at 580-581-3240 or contact the California Department of Justice Sacramento office at 916-227-3290. Inocente Richmond Yanez was born on August 29, 1972, and grew up in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. He was known by his nickname Sean. He also used the last names Gomez or Chavez as well. Sean is part American Indian and part Hispanic. In early January of 1999, Sean Yanez was 26 years old. He was a son and a father, having several children. Yanez was 6 feet 2 inches tall, weighed 180 pounds, wore short black hair and brown eyes when he vanished. Sean was his nickname, but also the main name he was referred to. He spoke with a speech impediment. Sean also had surgical scars on both of his wrists. Sean Yanez lived at home with his mother at the time he disappeared. They shared a home in the 500 block of May Avenue in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. On January 5, 1999, Sean's mother went to work, leaving him at home alone. He had reportedly told some other family members that he did have plans that day for a friend to give him a ride from the home. Any further details about this ride are unknown. When Yanez's mother returned home from work that January 5, 1999, she found Sean's lights and TV were left on. She also located his coat, cigarettes, and other personal belongings at their home. Investigators quickly found the disappearance to be suspicious and found it unusual for Yanez to leave home for a long period of time without any warning, especially since he lived with his mother and had young children. Sean's mother reported him missing officially on January 15, 1999, when he never returned home. Cherokee County was the first investigators on the case. They just never received very many credible tips. Yanez's mother has raised his children since he disappeared. They just refused to believe he would voluntarily stay away from his family for this long. Quote, "Someone out there knows where they're at. Someone out there knows what happened," said Jack Thorpe, the Cherokee County DA. Eventually, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation joined the search for Sean Yanez. An OSBI Special Agent Vicki Lyons was assigned the case. OSBI did work the case with Tahlequah and other agencies to locate Yanez and the people responsible, but they were hoping to find new leads. Quote, "We followed up on several leads and were anxious to be able to find Sean and bring more answers to his family," Lyons said. Quote, "We followed up on several leads and were anxious to be able to find Sean and bring more answers to his family," Lyons said. Quote, "With the passage of time, circumstances change, and we believe there is someone in the Cherokee County area who knows information that can help." Cherokee County District Attorney Jack Thorpe explained the case's limited facts when he said, quote, "We just need the right person to come forward." Special Agent Lyons further explained by saying, quote, "Not having any answers about their dad has caused anxiety for Sean's children over the years. We have indications that Sean met with foul play. His family and children don't believe that he would have voluntarily stayed away from his children this long." And in addition, the Cherokee County Undersheriff, Jason Chenault, said, quote, "It's something you think about every day, about his county's cold cases, including Yanez. Sean Yanez and five others are still missing from Cherokee County, and their disappearances are all suspicious and remain unsolved." Chenault also said, quote, "It's not our job to give up. We're here to give as much closure as we can to the family. Justice." The OSBI has offered a $3,000 reward for any information leading to an arrest and prosecution for Inocente Sean Yanez's disappearance on January 5, 1999, from his home in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Anyone with any information regarding the disappearance of Sean Yanez, please call the Tahlequah PD at 239-TIPS or call OSBI at 1-800-635-TIPS. Anthony Michael Lennon was 31 years old and had been working as the overnight clerk at the Super 8 Motel in Moore, Oklahoma, for about a year in early March 2012. Then, at approximately 6:30 p.m. on March 9, 2012, Anthony Lennon arrived at the Super 8 Motel to relieve his coworker. But by 3:30 a.m., on the early morning of March 10th, when the owners of the motel arrived, Lennon and the cash were missing. There was obvious signs of a robbery located in the office of the hotel. The owners called police. When he disappeared from his work, Anthony Michael Lennon was a 31-year-old white male. He was 6 feet tall, weighing 240, with long brown hair and green eyes when last seen. Lennon had past addresses in Moore and Norman, Oklahoma. The motel owners told investigators that they believed Lennon to be trustworthy. According to the Moore Police Department, they responded at approximately 4 a.m. to a possible robbery at the Super 8 Motel, located at 1520 North Moore Avenue in Moore, Oklahoma. Originally, Sergeant Jeremy Lewis with the Moore PD said, quote, "It's one of two things. Either he is a suspect, and we don't know until we find him. That's what it all hinges on. He is the only witness we have, and we haven't been able to locate him yet." Lennon was also wanted for additional child pornography charges when he went missing. Sergeant Lewis told reporters that when they do locate Lennon, they will arrest him for his additional charges. Lennon was originally arrested in 2008 for 5 charges of possession of child pornography. He pled guilty and was convicted on all 5 charges on December 17, 2010. He was sentenced to 30 days in jail and a 20-year suspended sentence. However, altogether, Lennon only served 13 days behind bars, even earning good behavior credit. Then, in November of 2011, police searched Lennon's home and confiscated a computer. Evidence from those sources led Cleveland County District Attorney Greg Mashburn to file a motion to revoke Lennon's suspended sentence on the basis of an, quote, "untruthful statement" to his probation officer and violation of Rule 8 that the, quote, "offender will not possess pornographic materials in any form," and Rule 10 that he will not have access to, quote, "any computer, internet site, chat room, or electronic communication through the use of a computer." A warrant for Lennon's arrest was issued at that time, with a $20,000 bond amount. He appeared in court on February 9th and posted a reduced bond of $10,000. Then, on March 7th, 2012, Lennon was charged with an additional 8 counts of possession of child pornography, with Moore Police as the arresting agency. The bail amount for this warrant was listed at $100,000. Quote, "He was one of our local sex offenders that was registered, but as far as problems, I don't know of any other than we do have a warrant for his arrest," Sergeant Lewis stated. Lennon's bosses at the motel stated they believed him to be trustworthy, but they were unaware of his record. But despite Lennon's unacceptable and disgusting actions, police had to admit quickly that it appeared he was the victim of an abduction. Police had to admit that based on the evidence located at the scene, they had to treat this as a robbery and abduction. Evidence at the scene, including blood, led investigators to believe Lennon was in danger. While police are withholding some details pending the outcome of the investigation, at the time, it was being treated as a robbery and possible abduction, Lewis said. Quote, "There is somewhat reason to believe that something may have happened," Lewis explained. Quote, "The clerk wasn't just missing with the money." The Moore Police Department is still attempting to locate Anthony Michael Lennon, not only for his child pornography warrants, but due to the evidence that he was abducted from the Super 8 Motel that was located in Moore, Oklahoma, on March 9, 2012. If you have any information, no matter how big or small, about Anthony Lennon's disappearance on March 9th, 2012, from the Super 8 Motel at 1520 North Moore Avenue, please contact the Moore PD at 405-793-5171. Shannon Michelle Baldwin Hokinson was born on December 2, 1982, and was from Enid, Oklahoma. Shannon was 29 years old and the mother to three children when she vanished. She was known to abuse drugs throughout her life, and this may have contributed to her disappearance. Shannon was last seen and last made contact over the phone with her friends and family on approximately May 27, 2012. However, Shannon wouldn't be reported missing in Enid, Oklahoma until August 7, 2012. Shannon was a white female, 5 feet 2 inches tall, weighing about 150 pounds, with brown hair and brown eyes. She had multiple tattoos that included a frog with a mushroom on the outside of her ankle, blue roses on her lower back, orange flower on her top left foot, a butterfly on the back of her right shoulder, a heart between her thumb and index finger, and unfinished flames running down her spine. Reports indicate Shannon was possibly last seen in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on May 27, 2012. And the friend that reported her missing told police she was possibly traveling to Las Vegas. Shannon Baldwin Hokinson never arrived, and she has never been heard from again. It's very uncharacteristic of Shannon not to respond to or reach out for this long a period of time to anyone. She normally would speak to family and friends at least once a week. Her last known phone usage was approximately May 27, 2012. Quote, "Everything stopped at the end of May. We hadn't gotten anything and couldn't get her to respond to us," Roni Kitchen said, a close friend of Shannon's. She knew something was wrong when Shannon quit responding to calls and texts. Quote, "I tried for several months," Kitchen stated. She is also the person that finally reported Shannon missing to the Enid PD. And immediately, Detective Sean Ramsey was assigned the case, and he still works it to this day. Quote, "I feel like she's out there. We just haven't found her yet," Ramsey explained. There is very few leads or tips regarding Shannon's disappearance. There's one report that on May 27, 2012, she was last seen with two men named Mark McVickers and Eric Herrera. McVickers supposedly had Shannon's car after she was last seen alive. This report also states that a witness named Lauren Nelson came forward and told police that McVickers told her that he dumped Shannon on the other side of the Texas border in a body of water. Shannon Hokinson has never been heard from again. The Enid detective Sean Ramsey had also been working this disappearance since August 7, 2012, which was when Shannon was finally reported missing by her friend, Roni Kitchen. Quote, "It's something I think about every day, and every day I'm at work, I work on it," Detective Ramsey stated. Two leads in the state of Oklahoma did show promise in Shannon's case. The first led investigators to a home in Garfield County, Oklahoma. Investigators spent days searching a property near Bison, Oklahoma, after they received a tip that Shannon's body had been left in a cellar there. Unfortunately, after police sifted through the dilapidated property, they walked away with no answers about Shannon. The second promising tip led police about a mile south of the originally searched home to a water well. The very rural setting was miles from any town. And unfortunately, it was just another dead end for police. Ramsey explained the feelings about not locating Shannon yet by saying, quote, "It takes its toll on you, not knowing where to find her, or if she's alive, or if she's dead." Roni Kitchen, Shannon's longtime family friend, is raising one of her sons, quote, "You have to have hope," Kitchen stated. She also has all along tirelessly created missing posters and websites to hopefully gain tips about Shannon's disappearance. Quote, "It doesn't matter what happened to her now. We just want to make sure we bring her home," Kitchen said. While Detective Ramsey believes Shannon met with foul play, he still holds hope that someone will come forward with information about this case. Quote, "The children deserve to know that their mother's at least been found," Detective Ramsey said. He explained further by saying, quote, "I'm hopeful that someone will call me one day or come to the station one day and say that they know where she is at." Then, in December 2019, an attorney in the Enid area filed a motion in the Garfield County Court to rule Shannon Baldwin Hokanson deceased. His intention to do so was to benefit Shannon's three children with death benefits. This caused the Enid Police Department to issue a statement on December 3, 2019. The statement said, quote, "Over the years, we have received a number of tips, interviewed a number of potential witnesses, cleared persons of interest, and searched homes and fields." The statement also added that Hokanson likely is a, quote, "victim of homicide." The Enid Police Department went on to say it has, quote, "identified individuals involved in Shannon's potential death," but that it can't release any of these facts publicly yet. Despite all the police investigations, Shannon Baldwin Hokanson has never been located or heard from alive again. She is presumed to be dead and to have met with foul play by police. Anyone with any information regarding the late May 2012 disappearance of Shannon Baldwin Hokanson is asked to please contact Enid Police Department by calling Crime Stoppers at 580-242-7000. Hey, fellow Okies and all true crime enthusiasts, Cece here, and I'm joined by a special guest, John, the host of True Crime XS Podcast. So welcome, John, and thanks for being here. Let's dive right in. So tell us about True Crime XS and why you decided to start the podcast.
So True Crime XS, I don't know how it started for you, but when I was younger, I was obsessed with disappearances from national parks and national forests, like back in the 90s. So I started seriously looking at those in like 2007, 2008, I think. And I didn't know who this killer was at that point in time. But a little later on, when I found out who he was, I started looking into him. And I would say that was probably like briefly in 2013. And I picked it back up in 2015, 2016. And then I really started researching him over the last 3 or 4 years for what became True Crime XS, because I wanted to tell the story of what I thought had happened.
So in this episode, I covered the cases of 4 missing people with links to the state of Oklahoma and possibly links to Israel Keyes. Tell me what links Keyes to my state.
And we linked Keyes, we linked this killer to multiple possibilities in Oklahoma. And he had an army buddy that he was close to. It was one of the only ones that he was close to. And when we tracked him down in 2014 or 2015, he was in Oklahoma. He had ties like all over the place, but he was in Oklahoma. And we could see he had sort of been in and out of Oklahoma. So that link was pretty solid. And when we started exploring like who he might have talked to and who he might have told things to, this guy was at the top of the list. And that's when we knew we had a definitive link there. Plus, Keyes traveled everywhere. And that was one of the big problems with tracking down his story. You have to find a hot spot, but then you have to figure out like where he traveled to and from to get there. And Oklahoma was one of those places.
So let's start with the 1999 cases, beginning with Boaz Zeno. What about his case can you add? And why do you possibly link him to Keyes?
What? I can't add much to Bo's story. He is from Oklahoma, and Oklahoma had the original investigation, and part of it was in California. What connects him to this killer is they both had Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and the U.S. Army in common at that time. Like, so our killer went in the previous year, and we felt like we couldn't really tell where he went missing. Some reports say California, some reports say Oklahoma. For all I know, Bo is still alive. But I originally had this spree that sort of started down by Fort Benning, and it went up through Kentucky and Oklahoma. And one of the Army buddies was from Oklahoma. So he was there a couple of different times. But that's all I have to connect him to Bo. And it's not pure speculation with Bo. There were some like really dubious reports as far as people who saw him in California were active duty soldiers, and we couldn't get all the way down to the names there. So what crops up about him is they assume that he's homeless. And for a while, there was another case that he was connected to in a way. And I don't know what happened to him. And that bothers me. So I really wanted to just daylight his case. I wanted to shine a little light on Bo's case in order for like people to hear about it. And like if someone knew something about it, to be able to sort of close that out. I don't like big open-ended cases. Where Bo comes back into play is the case of Lyle Stevick, who is a man who committed suicide in 2001 in Amanda Park, Washington, which is up on the Olympic Peninsula, which is where a lot of our story sort of either takes place or has roots. And now he's been identified at this point, and his relatives have basically asked that his identity be withheld. So we don't know that it's Bo, but I would think they would take Bo off of like the missing persons registries if that were the case. But he had this mysterious death. Basically, he checked into a motel. People thought he was maybe Canadian or he had an accent. And he gave a home address that was another motel. And essentially, you know, he committed suicide, and it was this big mystery for a long time where I had questioned whether or not that might have been Bo.
Shortly after Zeno disappeared, Sean Yanez also disappeared from Tahlequah, Oklahoma. What possibly links him to Israel Keyes?
So is Sean... So his nickname was Sean Yanez. So with him, he just fit the timeline and also happened to be in Oklahoma and had this mysterious disappearance. And some of the other people on the team had qualified like these mysterious disappearances as cases that we wanted to check out. And there are so few details available about Sean Yanez, and we weren't able to rule him in or rule him out. But he's another one of those cases that they were still offering rewards like well into his being missing. And I think at one point I saw a reward for $3,000 and a reward for maybe $8,000. And I wanted to spotlight his case more than I wanted to connect him back to this killer. I wanted people to, like, if they knew anything, to say something.
Is there any other cases from 1999 in Oklahoma that you loosely link to Israel Keyes?
And someone remarked, like, early on, with our 1999 cases that we were doing, they remarked that the Loria Bible and Ashley Freeman case looked a lot like Holly Bobo. And we had other cases that, like, we think... So a couple of people that I work with think that his preferred type were these young females between 16 and 25, give or take a year or two. And so they sort of fit. There was an arson involved. There were weapons involved. It was a remote location. That all made us look at that case pretty hard. And I don't have any further comment on that because there's pending legal stuff going on related to the Freeman and Bible disappearance. But we did consider it just like we considered Holly Bobo.
Okay, let's jump to 2012 when Anthony Lennon disappeared from Moore, Oklahoma. And then around the same time, Shannon Hokanson also went missing. What about these two cases possibly link them to Keyes?
So in 2012, like at the end of things, we have Shannon and we have Lennon. So Shannon's case sort of came last, because one of the people on the team realized that in the earliest interrogations, and the audio on them is terrible, the FBI agent that's involved, there's only one way back then that's really talking to Keyes. And he picks up on the idea that Keyes is saying there's a time-sensitive victim. So our thoughts were that maybe Shannon had been the time-sensitive victim, because she sort of disappears from social media in February into March in 2012. And Keyes was in Oklahoma. He was down there attending he was in Texas, not Oklahoma, sorry. But we could get him to Oklahoma in like a short drive for Keyes. And I hadn't even thought about the time sensitivity thing. That came from Meg, who I work with. And she said, like, you have to explore this angle because there could be victims, like, even after these other victims. And Lennon's case was so similar to the case of Samantha Koenig in Alaska. It was just one of these vanishings at their place of work. And he was there. He was in Texas, not, like, for him, it was not a terribly far drive. And then we knew that Shannon had been in Enid, Oklahoma, which was just north of Moore, Oklahoma, which is where Lennon disappeared from. So those two were interesting to us, and we sort of stuck with them, mainly to daylight their cases for different reasons. I mean, Shannon had kids, and like there was this whole thing to get her declared dead. And with Anthony Lennon, you know, we felt like maybe he needed to be found for other reasons. But just looking for him, like the trail that he left before he vanished, is so interesting. Like it's the craziest stuff. There's all these different ways that he was sort of involved in anime. And at one point he's building this like crazy aquarium, and we couldn't figure out like, what is he building this for? At first we were like, was he keeping people? And we couldn't decide. Like some of the folks that I work with were like, I think they would have been best friends forever. And you know, we're kidding, but ultimately his abduction was so similar to Samantha Koenig, just without the surveillance, that we felt like we had to at least like daylight his case. And he has a really sordid background. Like the stuff that had been going on one hand, the charges were absolutely terrible. But on the other hand, what we've found when we dug down deep was they were previous activities where he had pled out to, I don't want to downplay his charges, but some of the stuff that was in there was not nearly as serious as we thought it was when we started investigating it. And like, it was serious. It basically like surrounded allegations of child pornography, but some of what they were doing there related to drawings and some of it didn't. And we had a hard time telling what charges stemmed from where, looking at the paperwork, because it looked like everything stemmed from this original search warrant back in 2011. And they were going to revoke his probation, which gave him a reason to flee. And they were upping the charges and adding more counts. So we think he was just savvy enough that he might have staged his own disappearance and sort of vanished using some kind of plot. And if he did, we could probably pinpoint where he is. But we never found any proof of it. We found this one mention of him after that, and it seemed to be like a sort of a catalog of old information that he just was one of the many people they were talking about. And Meg got hung up on the fact that if the task force didn't find him, and his charges were serious enough that like the marshals would get involved, even in 2012. But Meg thought if they didn't find him, we weren't going to find him. And she was right. We didn't find any proof that he was definitely alive somewhere. And his disappearance was really dubious. Like the fact that he had just sort of vanished. I'll just say, if we found him, we have a lot of questions about him, like a lot. But we wanted to know if he was a like sort of a viable time-sensitive victim, because when they picked up Keyes down in Lufkin, we sort of toyed with the idea, like, was there somebody still alive? And, you know, the answer is we don't know, but he was headed somewhere. When he left, like, he didn't have his kid with him. His kid was, like, with his brother down at his mom's house, and he was headed somewhere. And he had an energy drink, and he had a sandwich. And we were like, I wonder what he was, like, going to do, because he was a spree serial killer. And we've sort of you know, I have a high number. The others like have questions about my number. But, you know, the truth is, like, I think he killed a lot of people. And I think he was pretty good at it overall to not get caught. You know, was there like one last victim in like Shannon or Lennon? I don't know if we'll ever know.
And what more can you tell us about Shannon's case?
And none of us want it to be Shannon. I mean, Shannon was already having a hard enough time and there's already enough suspicion there. But the truth is her disappearance, where there's no arrest made and like there's suspects and like weird things happen with like the cars. And like there were a couple guys there that they looked at really hard for her case. But and I believe one of them is deceased now. And like, that was not my case I was working on. I was like going through the research at sort of the end of it all. But, it's a really slim chance that he found her. It would have been because she was right off the highway and it would have been right after, Anthony Lennon. Now that brings like up another like weird thing of what we're doing with True Crime XS. Our primary focus has been locating the remains. And so there's a chance we could find one of them, but I don't think we find both of them because we think that like whoever the time sensitive victim, if that was a thing, we don't think that they were in the final spot. So while we know where we think the final locations are, like that wouldn't apply necessarily, probably to Shannon if she were to be his victim. But, you know, he could get places pretty quickly because he had no problems driving back roads, speeding. He'd use interstates only when he had to. He was a compulsive driver, which is like a big thing with certain serial killers. And the trip from Wells up to Oklahoma would have been nothing for him. And it would have been at a time with his sisters getting married like they were, he would have been able to disappear. And I don't think anybody in his family or anything really would have noticed or asked many questions.
Are there any other Oklahoma cases you have studied with links to keys?
And we are exploring a couple of other cases in Oklahoma. Like, they're later on. They're in 2009. And they're both pretty controversial cases. One of them involves a pastor in a church. And the other is a family that was found later, the Jameson family. And those, I don't think my opinion of, like, what went on there is going to be super popular. But I do feel like those are a couple more cases that need spotlighting. And we're focusing in on them. It'll be later in, I think it's like episode 18 or 19 of the 20 something that we're doing for the season. And, you know, we do come back, we hit on a couple of Oklahoma cases along the way just to see, like, because I considered that area to be one of his hotspots and we could prove he had traveled through there, but did he do any of this? I honestly can't tell you for sure that he did.
And what can you tell me about the bombshell you're promised to reveal in the season finale episode?
But a lot of what we've been doing, like with the analysis that we're doing with True Crime XS, it does lead somewhere. Like, it's not exactly where people are going to think. But the end result of all of our research and everything sort of came to a head with this one 2010 case. It's not an Oklahoma case. But we realized something with that case, and that is that we knew where the bodies were buried, because he used a common location, and it's a bombshell. Like, it's huge. Not only is it huge for like True Crime XS and for the case of like Israel Keys, this killer that we're dealing with, but it changes a lot about true crime. And when I say true crime, I mean like the last 30 or 40 years of true crime. And while I don't know how this works into season one, I can tell you that we identified 7 serial killers that we don't think anybody's picked up on. Like, other podcasts have sort of mentioned the cases together, but not all of them, like bits and pieces of them. And we came across like these different serial killers. One of them is, at least one of them is still active, but one of them is now dead. We were able to track him down. But the biggest thing for us was several of them had similar body locations in common. And the biggest deal of like the body locations is it's not just this guy. It's not just this killer. And he even says so. He says in the interviews, I wasn't the only one that figured this out. And he's sort of referencing a couple of things. One is he's referencing like his primary sites for abduction. Even though he did it several different places, he would go to these remote locations. Like, and I mean really remote locations. And some of them are like bizarre, but he would snatch people from there. And that was sort of his backup. Like if he couldn't find time to get into a little more urban area and get what, like he said, what he was looking for, I put big air quotes around that. If he couldn't find that, he would go to the, he would plan to go out to these remote locations. And that's what like we focused in on, was like, which one of those could we like locate, and who could we identify? And that is probably the biggest thing we did. So in wrapping that part up with finding those remote locations, like some of those people aren't considered to be missing persons necessarily. They're certainly not considered to be victims of crimes. They, like a lot of them are on like lost and injured lists or considered deceased because of where it was. But they, like, I think it will shock people to realize like these people were actually murder victims. And we've treaded this really like careful line because we don't want to just come out and like throw out this list and not back it up. But I think when people realize that he told the federal investigators where bodies were, in at least one instance, he was trying to describe where a body was and they weren't listening. But overall, he was using similar locations. And that part, that's going to blow everybody's mind.
Thank you so much for doing this interview and sharing your research on these cases with us. And please tell everybody where they can listen to your awesome podcast, because I'm certainly hooked.
I'm really glad you're doing your show. I like it. I like your show a lot. I hope that you cover a lot of these cases in more detail than I've been able to, because I'm sort of, you know, hitting them along the way as highlights as part of a bigger case. But you're right there. And I do think it's important for people to cover things that are local to them. And I like your show. I listen and enjoy hearing your research and hearing like your thoughts on this stuff. And I'm really glad that you were available for me to sort of do this together. It's really cool. And I look forward to listening to more of your stuff. And you can find us, any podcast app that they've got out there. You can find us at truecrimexcess.com or just by looking up truecrimexcess. We're on Twitter and Instagram, Apple Podcasts. The list goes on and on. But thank you for having me on, and keep up the great work. I appreciate it.
Thanks, y'all, so much for listening to the 8th episode of the Sooner State True Crime Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show and my interview with John of True Crime XS. Please be sure y'all check it out in Apple Podcasts or most apps. And again, if anyone listening has any information regarding the disappearance of Bo Zeno, contact the Lawton Police Department. The disappearance of Sean Yanez, contact the OSBI. The disappearance of Anthony Lennon, contact the Moore Police Department. Or the disappearance of Shannon Hokinson, contact Enid PD. And all the numbers are listed in the show notes. Please be sure y'all subscribe and leave us a 5-star review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps and it's free. Check us out on Twitter at Crime State or on Instagram and Facebook, OK Crime State. And as always, please send me any comments or case suggestions to SoonerStateCrimePod@gmail.com. From now until the end of May, SSTC will donate 30% of our tip jar donations to virus relief. So please donate, y'all. Episode 9 of our show will be released on April 19th for the 25th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing instead of the 15th. Thank you, Dating Confessions with Alicia and Jack Podcast, Motherhood Unstressed CBD, and Ghost Town Podcast for sponsoring this episode. Their links are all listed in the show notes. And thank you again to John and True Crime XS for joining the show. Please be sure y'all check them out. Well, I think that's everything. I just want to thank y'all again for listening to my podcast and the positive response. It really means so much. Thank y'all, and I pray that each and every one of you and your entire family stay safe during these difficult times. Thanks again. And as always, but now more than ever, everyone, please stay sooner safe out there, y'all.